Are your school days out of sight? When you took English, art, and math, what's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I am your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning host, David Lehr.
Lore.
Why does that always happen? I look at the way it's spelled.
Everyone looks at lore. The E, and then they're like, that's the one. Yes, we'll go with the E.
It's lore, as in the lore about our favorite author, Nathaniel Hawthorne.
That's right.
Which we are doing this time. We did previously do an episode of Sophomore Lit. David was not here for that, on The Scarlet Letter. And it has come to my attention from several of my readers that Nathaniel Hawthorne is a divisive author. Many modern readers have nothing but bad memories of reading Hawthorne when they were kids. But for better or for worse, Hawthorne was the author that I got assigned just all the time in high school. There were two classes, one in which we read The Scarlet Letter, and before we read The Scarlet Letter, we read both Young Goodman Brown and The Minister's Black Veil. And then there was another class in which we read the two stories that we're going to read this time for the podcast, The Birthmark and Rappaccini's Daughter. What's your background with Hawthorne?
It's much milder, at least school wise. We did The Scarlet Letter in 10th grade, so it counts. And I did not like it at the time. I still don't entirely like it. I was not a huge fan of that. I much prefer his short work. But never got Young Goodman Brown in school. Pretty much the only other Hawthorne we got in school was Rappaccini's Daughter. And even at that, we didn't read it. We saw the, American Playhouse adaptation of it with Kathleen Beller and other people, which is actually a pretty good adaptation. They tended to do a good job with that. But it was an adjunct to The Scarlet Letter. We had one of those team taught things where it was like, you always had history and English back to back. So it was like this, it could go to a giant two period class if it had to. And so all of the literature was matched up to the period of history that we covered that year. And so we wound up doing The Crucible and Sister Carrie and Scarlet Letter and, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God, which technically isn't a story. It's a sermon, but, but it was, you know, there were some interesting things that year. Those were the things I didn't like. I guess we did The Great Gatsby that year. I did like The Great Gatsby.
Well, Hawthorne is, I think, I would say it's an acquired taste, except I always liked him.
Well, it can be.
Which makes me very strange. But I guess I feel a little bit proprietary towards Hawthorne because I live... The house where I live right now is just about a mile and a half away from Brook Farm, which is the utopian community that Hawthorne worked at for a year, where he met his wife.
Right.
And I'm also, you know, in Boston, very close to Concord, where Hawthorne then moved and lived in the old manse up there, which is the titular manse from Mosses from an Old Manse, which is the story collection that both of these stories were eventually published in. So he's a kind of a local boy.
Yeah.
He was great friends with Herman Melville, and you can kind of see that in these stories.
Well, yeah, Bartleby the Scrivener was another thing we did that year.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of. What do you think of that?
Oh, I'd prefer not to.
But you were the one who brought up Rappaccini's Daughter, so
Hawthorne is someone I came back to. And there are authors from high school that I did not like at the time and came back to with a greater appreciation. At least with the short work, that's how I came back to Hawthorne. It was kind of when I fell into Poe and Harlan Ellison and O. Henry and you know, going deep into the Twilight Zone, and just seeing how all of these things connected and influenced one another. And if the only thing you knew of Hawthorne was The Scarlet Letter, his short work is going to blow your mind, right? This is not at all what you expect.
No, I think that's a good point. His short work is often given over to the highly mystical, or there's supernatural elements in it. They're very strange. I mean, you wouldn't call them necessarily horror stories or thrillers the same way you would call Edgar Allan Poe a horror story,
right?
But they are
horrific.
Mysterious. Yeah, they are horrific, and they are gothic, and that was the culture of short stories at the time. There were a lot of ghost stories being published in journals. It was a highly popular medium or genre at the time, just as today it seems like every second movie that comes out is a superhero movie. If you opened up a general readership journal in the early 1800s, I would say quite a few of those would be ghost stories or gothic stories. Or, I mean, this was not too far out from the beginning of gothic literature.
Right, right. I mean, you know, I always knew the name Twice Told Tales. Had never read it, right? Yeah. That's just one of the titles you see next to his name when you learn about him.
When you play authors.
Right, right. And, you know, going back and reading them was just a revelation.
Right. Well, let's just dive into these two stories. These two stories were written shortly one after another. We'll start with The Birthmark, because that was the first of the two stories, and I think it's probably the lesser of the two.
Yeah.
But it does share a lot of the themes and concerns, and you can kind of see how Rappaccini's daughter grows out of that in just a year's time, because this was the original Birthmark was published in 1843. And this is the story that takes place in the 18th century, and we don't know where the hell it takes place because he never says, but we have characters named Aylmer and Georgiana, so it might be America? I don't know. anyway, the Aylmer is a super scientist who has turned momentarily from his test tubes to matrimony, marrying the beautiful Georgiana, who owns the titular birthmark of the story, which is a tiny reddish hand shape on her cheek, sort of like the world's smallest slap. Aylmer can't stop thinking about the birthmark, explaining to his wife that he had a dream of trying to cut it from her face. And even though this dream ends with the birthmark continuing to worm its way down into her heart, Georgiana says, sure, go ahead and get rid of my birthmark. That would be great. She's taken up into his laboratory, where he works with a henchman named Aminadab, who thinks that the birthmark is just fine the way it is, but in a series of increasingly obvious metaphors, Aylmer concocts experiments to amuse his wife to show how well he can do science, but they all end in these ominous portents. Aylmer and Aminadab do something sciency and create a potion that's supposed to cure her, and to demonstrate this, he cures the spots on a geranium. And sure, so what can go wrong? Georgiana drinks the potion and has a nap. Her birthmark fades and disappears, but when she wakes up, it turns out that the mark was the only thing that was keeping her alive, and she dies, much to the amusement of Aminadab and the scolding of the narrator.
which is scientifically valid. Totally, that's how birthmarks work.
Exactly. Now, that's a good point you bring up here, because both of these stories have this preoccupation with science, ostensibly, but they don't really seem to know much about anything.
Right.
But
right.
But it's sort of like science is now standing in for magic, because why not?
Right. Well, I have this theory about the Twilight Zone too, that, I mean, there are a lot of things, obviously, certainly space and astronomy things now that we know are wrong in the show. They didn't, you know, Serling didn't know that then. Doesn't change how effective the stories are. It doesn't matter how many millions of miles the sun is away from the Earth. It's still a good story. And that's okay here, too. It's not, they don't have to be absolutely scientific. You know, alchemy. Right. You may call it alchemy. It's not even science.
Sure.
Right.
Well, Aylmer brings up alchemy in this, right. and he seems to... He brings up a lot of odd things that he says he can do. He talks about a potion he has that could kill anyone, and it seems from the way that he's talking about it, it could kill them whenever he wanted it to, maybe without even administering it. I don't know.
Right.
It's a very confusing thing.
If I look at it very carefully and think about a person, poof.
Now there's an interesting dynamic here between, you know, let's start by talking about the birthmark, I guess, because obviously that's the major metaphor of the story,
right?
And one thing to point out about this this story is it has a very chatty and scolding narrator. The narrator is going to tell you exactly how he feels about everything that's going on in the story, and he's going to give his own opinion about what he thinks everything means, even as Aylmer is going to give his opinion about what he thinks everything means, and Aminabad. I mean, everyone's talking about meaning in this story. One thing that I think that struck me on this read through is, when I was a kid, these stories struck me as very dour and moralistic and kind of somber and obvious. But now that I'm older, I see that Hawthorne is actually playing around with voice a lot. And there's a lot of weird humor going on in these stories, to the point where I don't really trust the narrator any more than I trust anyone else in the story.
Right. Right. And that's another thing where, you know, again, maybe the narrator doesn't understand science. That's okay. These are definitely, both of them, stories that play better and maybe even more tragically 30 years later reading them. I think you need some mileage to really appreciate certainly where the scientist character and the father in the next story are, where they're just sort of, This is a thing you should not do. Trust me, right? And when you're young, you don't know anything. I can do that. I liken this, the henchman. Always listen to your henchman, at least in a Hawthorne story. When he says, you know, the birthmark looks fine. It's all right.
Yeah.
You know, what's wrong with you that this is a problem? It's kind of like a George Costanza thing, right? It's like that one thing that drives him crazy about the perfect woman.
Right. Now, Aminadab is an interesting character in a way, because he's obviously the Igor character of the story. But when you think about it, he predates Igor.
Yes.
Because Frankenstein was written in 1822, but the original novel has no Igor. Igor doesn't come along until the James Whale film, and even then he's named Fritz the first time around.
Right.
So in a way, this is kind of the prototype of a mad scientist henchman. I don't know if there's any precursor for this.
I wouldn't be surprised if that intentionally influenced the Frankenstein film, and then of course everything since then.
Yeah. Well, It's interesting to think about. Now, Aminadab is not, you know, he's not a hunchback. I was wondering about the name Aminadab. I was looking that up, and he's a kind of an unvariegated ancestor of Christ. You know, when you read those those long genealogies right. at the beginning of Matthew. He's listed there.
All the begats.
But he's also apparently like a bad guy character in Mormon scripture. And I don't know anything about that.
Interesting.
And I don't want to say anything untowards because I don't know about this. This is not my faith tradition, but I'm curious to know more.
Well, and there are always interesting strains of faith and religion in all of Hawthorne. It's, you know, it's just there.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be surprised if he knew both of those.
But when was that founded? Was that at this?
That was somewhere in there. I believe it or not, I just saw a play about Joseph Smith and the birth of the Mormon religion.
Right.
I can't remember the date, but
okay.
but it was in that same kind of setting, same era.
Sure.
So I'm sure it was not too far. Right. It's not like we don't have computers; we could look this up.
Aminadab, I like as a sidekick because he's presented like he's going to be some sort of a brutish character, but he, unlike Aylmer, is able to find beauty in the birthmark, and he has an interesting mixture of sort of sensitivity and brutishness. I mean, he is going to go along with whatever his master tells him to do, but he's also going to enjoy a good laugh at the death of his master's wife at the end of the story.
Right. Sort of an extreme "I told you so,"
right? And it ends up. I don't know to what extent we're supposed to. The narrator at the end of the story says when that when Georgiana wakes up and expires, the reason she's dying is that the birthmark is the only thing that's holding her soul in place, because it's this...
It's the shape of a hand.
It's a shape of a hand, but it's also sort of a piece of corruption and
right.
imperfection,
right.
and that's what makes you human, and therefore that's what's keeping the divine aspect of you within your body. Now, that sort of smacks of, oh, she lost the will to live in a way. I don't know that I really want to trust the narrator on this.
Right.
Because you could see the birthmark in any number of ways, I suppose. Symbols in both of these stories, Hawthorne plays with that idea of symbols. He's going to tell you, everyone's going to tell you what it means, and then you have to kind of decide whether you believe anyone.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Now, this is a very simple story. I don't want to I don't want to drag it out any longer than we have to, but I did want to cover it because I do think that there are strong parallels, and maybe when we talk about Rappaccini's Daughter, we can draw the comparison between the two. I think that to enjoy the birthmark, you have to enjoy Hawthorne's digressive nature, because everything in this story is a digression.
Right. Right. Yeah, and it kind of, again, going back to Rod Serling, it kind of reminded me of a night gallery more than a Twilight Zone. Right? which he did embrace the Gothic in that.
Right.
But it was just sort of like, there's not really a twist. There's not really a surprise. It's more of, we kind of thought this was going to happen, and it happened. Ah, tough luck.
Now, that's a really good point, because all through this story, we keep getting foreshadowing of the eventual failure and death of Georgiana. And as a young reader, I was very frustrated with that.
Right.
Kind of like, oh, this seems very obvious. Now,
well, it's almost like a Roadrunner and Coyote cartoon after a while.
Right.
Right. It, you know, it just keeps happening. Sure. And you're going, oh, that one's going to fail too. Oh, and the last one failed too. Who could have seen that happen coming, right? But when you're older, totally different context, totally different feeling to that.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to Rappaccini's daughter.
Well, before we do, I did look it up.
Oh, you do?
The Joseph Smith founded Mormonism in the 1820s, and it gained popularity in the 1830s and 40s, and he died in 1844. So that's right about the right period.
Well, there's our answer, I guess. Yeah. Now, Rappaccini's daughter is published in 1844 in its original form. Now, both of these stories, when they were collected in Mosses from the Old Manse, that was in 1846 for anyone who's keeping score at home. So Rappaccini's daughter, I'll preface it by saying if people will think back to Fall of the House of Usher, which I did on an earlier podcast, it shares with Poe that fascination with Europe in decline. I think that this really marked a lot of American Gothic production, was Americans having no long sense of their own history looked to Europe for these kinds of mysterious and broken places, and there was a kind of a trope that ran through all these things of Europe in its dotage getting inbred and falling away, and I think that that comes in this story too.
Right.
So this starts with our young hero named Giovanni Guasconti. He arrives in Padua to attend the university there, and he lives in the crazy old ruin of a manor whose only other inhabitants seem to be the landlady and the titular Dr. Giacomo Rappaccini and his beautiful, mysterious, and strangely odorous daughter, Beatrice. Rappaccini is a professor of botany at the university, and his specialty is the study and breeding of deadly plants, especially flowers, which fill the courtyard of Giovanni's lodgings, and with which Beatrice delights in mingling, making her poisonous to lizards, insects, and other flowers. Although Giovanni is inclined to overlook this. At the university, Rappaccini's colleague, Professor Pietro Baglioni, talks smack about the crazy old plant man, claiming that he'd sacrifice anything or anyone for the sake of his work, and that Beatrice is also bad news, being literal poison.
That girl is poison.
When Giovanni finds that he, too, has become poisonous from hanging out with Beatrice, he berates her, but she pleads her soul's virtue in spite of her body's toxicity. At a second meeting, Baglioni produces an antidote that he says will cure Beatrice of her poisonous nature, which it does, with only one side effect, killing her.
Whoops. to quote some like it hot, nobody's perfect.
Now, I've deliberately glossed over a lot of things here and make it a little lighter.
It is a dark and heavy story.
It is a dark and heavy story, yeah. But here's the thing. It starts with an extended bit of pastiche of Hawthorne taking a piss on himself. he introduces the story as being, what is it?
It's translated from the French. By basically his name in French.
Right.
And some of his other works.
Monsieur de Lobepine.
They all translate as the French titles of various of his things. And right. So you kind of, if you notice that, you're like, what's he doing? What's going on here?
it's a very long introduction to what's going to be a short story, and the funny thing is the editorial voice is making fun of this fictitious French version of himself, saying that he's neither a transcendentalist nor is he a popular author. He's kind of somewhere in between, and he's not smart enough for smart people to like, nor is he, but he's too egg-headed for people who just want to read a good story.
Right.
So from the beginning, its point of view is kind of satirical, and that can't help but color all the events that take place.
Well, and it is very. I don't know if this was quite in style yet, but it's very Grand Guignol as a result. It's kind of, he's separating himself out and kind of making fun of that style. And yet, you know, like the TV adaptation of it stripped all that away and just did the story. And it works. It works as a really horrific gothic story. But it is adding that layer of metatext to it is a lot of fun.
Right. I mean, the other thing is, you know, when he shows up in Padua, they talk about coming into this kind of ruined old manor house that has now become a lodging place, and he talks about seeing a coat of arms over the door that was to the family that originally owned the house, and he recalls that the former owner was placed by Dante into hell in the Inferno. And it's just so over the top. Talk about literal Italy in decline and accursed ground. You know, even before these plants sprung up, there was trouble.
Right. Well, and just to make a quick tangent back to the Scarlet Letter, since you mentioned Dante, I always knew if I was going to go to graduate school, this would be my thesis. And since I know I'm never going to graduate school, here you go. So we read The Scarlet Letter, and my mother at the time decided to reread it too. She's like, "Hey, I'll read it with you." And she started to get fascinated by it. And at about the same time, John Updike put out The Witches of Eastwick, and then followed that up with Roger's version, and then followed that up with S. Now, he said explicitly the book S is a modern day, you know, rethinking of The Scarlet Letter. And it's, you know, it's also wild. It's totally different, too. But, of course, S is, you know, well, anyway, long story short, looking at those three books, and I thought, you know, S is presented as an analog of paradise. The Witches of Eastwick is really kind of hell. And Roger's version could be seen as a form of purgatory. But then, you know, what if those three books scan to the Scarlet Letter? And then looking at that, the three main characters in the Scarlet Letter track to the Divine Comedy. And there are a lot of little references throughout the Scarlet Letter that make me think, yes, he was intentionally doing that. And so I always wanted to sort of sit down with all of those books and just put it all together. Someone do that, please. I don't want to.
Wow, this sounds like you were writing fan fiction theories,
right?
Before there was a World Wide Web,
right? Suck it, Dan Brown.
You were truly an innovator here.
Yeah, I mean that was what 1990, 91, somewhere in right. there, and there so when I see other references to Dante throughout Hawthorne, it's like, yep, there you go. Anyway,
well this.
Oh, and yeah, of course, Beatrice, story, you know, that's...
Right. Well, exactly. We've got Beatrice. We've got... We open with references to Dante. We open with references to classical. There's like a statue. I forget what it was. It was some Roman name of a statue in the garden.
Right.
We're also... Immediately, he goes right to the Garden of Eden when he talks about his similes. So we have this preoccupation with metaphor and typology and symbolism. And of course, this is being written in the midst of the Victorian era in which the language of flowers was so prominent. The Victorians, probably most people out there are familiar with this, but they believed that all flowers had a sentiment attached to them. And so when you sent someone a bouquet, if the person could pick out each flower and know what the symbolism was, they would know exactly what the message was that was being sent by this bouquet of flowers.
Right.
Now, this is kind of this is an evil version of that. Partly because when Giovanni looks into the garden, he immediately doesn't know any of these flowers. They all seem to be perversions of nature to him.
Which is just a little creepy and should kind of make him a little afraid, but nope. Nope, he's curious. Yeah. Which reminds us of another garden where someone is curious about something and takes a bite of an apple exactly. And nope.
Now you do mention Beatrice as another link to Dante. For those of you who don't recall, Beatrice is of course the departed spirit of Dante's beloved, who ultimately, you know, takes him on this journey into heaven at the end. So there's this kind of people, younger readers will probably recognize the name Beatrice from the Lemony Snicket books. That's also a Dante reference there.
Yes.
So anyone who reads this would leap to mind immediately, partly because of the Italian setting. So already we have this the symbol of sort of unattainable love, of the love that in some ways transcends death, but is also it's kept separate by death
and inextricably linked with death.
Exactly. And when Beatrice shows up at first, she speaks in these kinds of declamatory sentences to the flowers, to the very flowers, about like, oh, my beautiful flowers, come give me your breath. You know, it's this kind of ridiculously over the top.
It is quite literally florid.
and again, I think that as a young reader, I would have just kind of marked this off as purple prose.
Right.
But I think Hawthorne knows exactly what he's doing here. He's writing a kind of a story that is, on the one hand, ridiculous and dares you to take it seriously. On the other hand, as you go along, you can't help but kind of get wrapped up in the drama of what's happening.
Right, right. And like I said, you know, I joke about it being florid, but I think that is intentional. I think that's very much, you know, and he's set her up as someone who has, you know, her father is the only other human she has contact with. So, you know, of course she's going to talk to whomever is right there, and it just happens to be flowers. And, right. And you know, you kind of think, well, okay, that's silly, but at the same time, that's really, really sad.
Right. Now she plucks one flower and holds it to her bosom, and the sap from it drips down onto a lizard and kills it. And I actually laughed aloud when I read that at this time because it's so absurd. It seems like Monty Python at that point.
Yeah,
it's sort of like,
yeah. It's Chekhov's sap. it is a nice laying of groundwork.
The beautiful daughter of Rappaccini plucked one of the richest blossoms of the shrub and was about to fasten it in her bosom. But now, unless Giovanni's drafts of wine had bewildered his senses, a singular incident occurred. A small orange-colored reptile of the lizard or chameleon species chanced to be creeping along the path just at the feet of Beatrice. It appeared to Giovanni, but at the distance from which he gazed, he could scarcely have seen anything so minute. It appeared to him, however, that a drop or two of moisture from the broken stem of the flower descended upon the lizard's head. For an instant, the reptile contorted itself violently, and then lay motionless in the sunshine. Beatrice observed this remarkable phenomenon and crossed herself, sadly, but without surprise. Nor did she therefore hesitate to arrange the fatal flower in her bosom. There it blushed and almost glimmered with the dazzling effect of a precious stone, adding to her dress and aspect the one appropriate charm which nothing else in the world could have supplied. But Giovanni, out of the shadow of his window, bent forward and shrank back and murmured and trembled.
Giovanni, watching from his window, throws her a bouquet of flowers that he purchased and says, "Here are healthy flowers. Please wear these." And I was thinking to myself, that's sort of the 19th century equivalent of, you know, you ought to smile more. You'd really be beautiful.
Yes. And depending on the flowers, again, the reader would know what they were supposed to mean.
We never get to see what it is that he's here to study in Padua. I mean, there is something else here that a reader in America at the present date might not understand, which is he's coming from our hero is coming from South Italy. At one point, it's suggested he comes from Naples. It's not made explicit, but the landlady mentions you left behind Naples, which is a coastal city. It's one of the biggest cities in Italy, and it's a kind of a very metropolitan area. And he's moving up to Padua. Now, Padua is just south of the Dolomites, south of the Alps. It's a city that's known for its ancient university. It was one of the oldest universities in all of Europe, and it's kind of like going. It's like traveling from, I don't know, like traveling from California to a tiny town in Maine or something like that.
Right.
You know, it's dreary. They remark on the weather being so kind of dour and everything. So keep that in mind when you think about this. I never quite figure out what it is he's here to study, because it seems like he drops that whole thing right away as soon as he sees Beatrice. So what about this guy that he meets at the university, Dr. what's his name?
Pietro.
He's a funny guy. He really does not have a high opinion of Rappaccini. And the interesting thing to me is that all these learned men of science have such a literary way of looking at the world.
Mm.
When he talks to Giovanni about why he might not want to hang around with Beatrice, he gives this story from antiquity of a poisonous Indian maiden who was sent to Alexander the Great. And I just don't know that you'd find many botanists today who that's where they would go right away.
Well, and that is a legitimate thing from historical literature. And surely inspired the story to begin with. The idea of basically turning a woman into a vial of poison with which to kill someone comes from a lot of Eastern myths and stories. And so, you know, again, seeing that pop up, you go, ah, okay. You're giving us that expression. Okay.
Right. Now, Rappaccini remains, Dr. Rappaccini, not the daughter, remains a bit of a cipher too. He shows up at the very end of the story to kind of give some explanation of what he's been on about. And it's kind of like one of those crazy, like, I've made up a half monkey, half horse for you sort of thing, where he says, like, well, you know, I made you poisonous, and now I secured you this boy here who's also poisonous, and now you'll be happy together.
Isn't it enough to know that, like, I ruined a pony making a gift for you?
Yes. So it's... It doesn't really explain anything. Why he decided to make his daughter poisonous in the first place. I also wonder what happened to the mom. Did they ever mention that?
I don't recall that. And certainly there are no child protective services.
Right. She mentions, the daughter, Beatrice, mentions that the particularly poisonous plant, the one that killed that little lizard, is as old as she was, that the two of them are kind of joined mystically because it was planted on the day that she was born and she grew up with it. So there's this kind of a way that plant is her familiar almost. And one of the things that I became fascinated with as I read through this time is Giovanni is warned off by the other professor at the university by saying that her very nature is evil. Her very nature is poisonous, and he, for a while he feels that. He feels that she is poisonous, and it kind of seems like it's going to be a standard 19th century trope of sort of the femme fatale luring men to their doom.
Right.
But then she pleads back that her this thing about her soul being pure, even though her body is actually poisonous. And, I kind of feel that as well. And it's not clear in the end. In the end, when she's given the antidote that is supposed to... And, of course, the antidote works because it's the exact opposite of everything that she's been poisoned with.
Is right.
That's what it's made of. That's the way science works. And when she expires, it's because her life at that point, that's all that's sustaining her is this poison. So it starts, the whole metaphor starts to become complicated or break down. You're not quite sure what to think about this anymore. Like what this ultimately is a metaphor for. Whether she's supposed to represent just some pure naive that has been buffeted by fate, or whether she does represent some sort of insidious force in the world, or whether, you know, I think as a modern reader, you kind of want to say, like, well, if he could have just embraced the darkness within, maybe he would have been able to, I don't know.
Right. Sort of a live and let live kind of idea.
I like the way that he sets up the symbolism of the story and then kind of thwarts it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know in the end what this is all supposed to mean, or whether in the end you're supposed to say, maybe it didn't mean anything. Maybe it was just a bunch of stuff that happened, as they said in The Simpsons.
Right. Well, that's where the metatext comes in, where it's like, all right, here is a story that you are used to. Here is this type of genre story, but it's all kind of silly. And I know that, and I'm saying that you should know that too.
I think that's absolutely true, particularly given the introduction. And ultimately, though, it's like one of those, like some of the best parodies out there, in that they are also become perfect examples of the genre that they're parodying.
Right.
If anyone reads this with an open mind and has the patience to wade through a decidedly 19th century style, you will find yourself being caught up and affected, even as you say, this is the stupidest thing I've ever read.
Yeah, and it is an acquired taste. It really is dense language used densely, right? Which, I mean, I don't know if my son has read any Hawthorne yet in school. I don't know if they even bother now. Because
your son in high school now?
Yeah, he's in 9th grade. He's going to go into 10th grade next year. So we may have a whole bunch of new things for you next year. We'll find out.
We've run through this rather quickly. I don't want to like leave anything out. Is there anything you want to touch on here?
Staying on brand for The Incomparable, I should say this was an inspiration for Poison Ivy in Batman. It's not coincidence. It's not, you know, hey, that sounds like Poison Ivy. Yes, there's a reason why. That's why. there have been a couple of adaptations. I'm surprised looking at things like Twilight Zone and Night Gallery that, and all the other shows like that, I should say, that more of Hawthorne hasn't been adapted to those kind of things. The Birthmark has never been adapted as far as I can tell. That's crazy to me. That's, you know, I can see how to film that. I'd love to film that. There are many other things I'd rather film, but I can see it. But Rappaccini's daughter has had a couple of adaptations. It's been a play a couple of times. And a couple of years ago, it was turned into a musical by, Brendan Milburn and Valerie Vigoda from the band Groove Lily. They've done a couple of plays now, Striking 12, which is a great version of The Little Match Girl. and a couple of other things. I think they did a Midsummer Night's Dream adaptation. They did an adaptation of this called Beautiful Poison that resets it into New Orleans. So there's a lot of jazz and Cajun style, and it's really kind of nice.
When you look at early American fiction, you had Washington Irving from the beginning. You had a novel that a lot of people don't know, which is called Wieland, which was the first novel published in America, which was a story about a psychic ventriloquist who convinces people that there are that there's a ghost haunting them. you have Poe, you have Hawthorne, you have Melville, who wrote you know that there are certainly mysterious, strange things happening in Melville. And then after the Civil War, realism takes hold very strongly with people like Twain, and then going into the Gilded Age with people like Edith Wharton or whatever. And all the stuff that was the mainstream of American literature gets relegated into, oh, that's genre fiction, that's weird fiction, and that, you know, and it gets, the ball gets picked up by people like, you know, H.P. Lovecraft in the early 20th century, but it never again gets to be the center of the literary world.
Right.
And it's funny that that's, that this stuff today is taught in school very seriously as this is serious literature, and then the people who, I would say the direct descendant of this kind of writing are people like Lovecraft, and that has only recently started to attract anything like mainstream scholarship.
Right. Even someone like Stephen King, who, I mean, certainly very popular, certainly everybody knows who he is and what he does, but even until recently, he's still relegated to his own section of the bookstore in horror. It's not, you know, he may have a bestseller every time he puts it out, but it's still not necessarily in the mainstream fiction section.
I think the idea of genre as a marketing tool probably grew up more in the early 20th century with the explosion, with late 19th, early 20th century, with the explosion of printing,
right,
in this country, right, with all the journals that came out.
Well, and with all the dime novels and the pulp fiction and even the syndicates, like did Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew and The Shadow and all that stuff.
And of course that makes it makes the works sell better, because the audiences kind of gravitate towards the subject matter that they like. But it has this kind of weird side effect of making some genres seem unworthy or unimportant or merely genre.
Right, right.
Anyway, I'm sure that better minds than I have probably written many, many monographs on the subject.
Well, and kind of going in the opposite direction, part of the reason The Twilight Zone even exists is because Rod Serling had a lot of trouble getting things on the air after a while set in the present day, that he wanted to talk about certain issues, and they would get watered down. And he finally, he wanted to do the Emmett Till story, and he wrote it pretty straight. And when it got on the air, it had been set 150 years earlier in a Mexican village, and it bore almost no relation to the real thing. And he said, you know, I can do the stories I want if they're set in this really weird science fiction-y setting, because they're not going to notice what I'm talking about. They're going to notice the science fiction, and they'll let it go. And that's the only reason The Twilight Zone exists. And so maybe it's easier to deal with these things in that genre.
Right. I agree, except to get back to Hawthorne, I still don't know what the hell he's trying to say in some of these stories.
Yeah, they're a little weird. Just a little.
Okay, are we done? We
may be Hawthorned out. I don't know.
Thanks again to co-host David Lohr. You can hear David on a variety of Incomparable Network podcasts, including The Incomparable Radio Theater. Speaking of The Incomparable Network, thanks to Jason Snell for doing this episode's reading. Why not check him out on any number of podcasts, including Robot or Not? While I'm recommending things, check out my other podcast, Clickacast, a Beverly Cleary podcast, which I do with my friend Phil Gonzalez, in which we read all of Beverly Cleary's books. We've made it through the 50s, and we're almost up to Ralph S. Mouse. And while we're at it, give a listen to Phil's other podcast, Deep in Bear Country, where he discusses all things Berenstain Bears. It's been a few weeks since I've done an episode, and I apologize. But I've got several in the works, and this summer I'm going to try to return to something more like a regular schedule. In the meantime, you can talk with me and other listeners on the Facebook Sophomore Lit page. You can join in the discussion on the Incomparable Listener Slack, or you can write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. And as always, everything will be on the final.